Here we go again, my friends. Another episode of the hashtag CNF podcast, where I speak with authors, reporters, writers, and filmmakers about creating works of nonfiction. Everything from the process of writing a book or a long article to the influential books and inspirations that make whatever it is they do that special. So, with the latest episode of the podcast, we're dealing with episode 23 with Tom Stanton, author of Terror in the City of Champions, Murder, Baseball, and the Secret Society that Shocked Depression-Era Detroit. So be sure to give the podcast a subscribe, share it with friends, and sign up for my email newsletter over at brendanomera.com. And without further ado, here's Tom Stanton. You know, a lot of the work that you've done is very, like, Michigan-Detroit-centric, and I wonder... Is it safe to say that you have, like, what is the connection that you feel so deeply with Detroit and Michigan?
Yeah, well, I've lived most of my life in Detroit area, and I'm probably the fourth generation, fifth if you include my sons, who aren't in Michigan right now, to be in this area. So we go back to my great-grandfather, and I grew up with the stories of my father, who... passed last year at 94, and he came from a large Polish Catholic family on the east side of Detroit. And when I was a kid, at the holidays, the aunts and uncles would all come to our home for the holiday celebration, and they'd reminisce. And a lot of seeds for my stories were planted at that point. I know it sounds kind of absurd, but. Things we're fond of when we're young, I think, are, for many of us, material that we've drawn over the years repeatedly. And that has been the case for me. And it's kind of, in some ways, part of my niche. I know Detroit. I know Detroit sports history very well. And it's really unusual that I go outside of that. I mean, the one exception was the Hank Aaron book that I did with HarperCollins in 2004, but other than that, there's been a Detroit connection to all of the work, and it's such an interesting story through the decades, Detroit, in terms of its rise and its fall, and hopefully its rise again. And you have everything here, darkness and lightness, and just such a diverse, interesting cast of characters, over the century plus that I've focused my work.
Yeah, and it seems in a lot of ways that it's kind of like a writer's dream to have a city that has so much depth and character and those ebbs and flows of and peaks and valleys. So is that another reason that maybe, like, have you ever been tempted to write about something else, but you always just feel this gravitational pull towards your home city, but also a city that just lends itself to such great narrative?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting observation. I guess I've never really viewed it that way, because I do have a whole list of, book ideas that I bounce around, and a lot of them have nothing to do with Detroit, but it is perhaps it's telling that I do keep coming back to this subject matter. You don't usually hear about the books that an author is not done, but I mean, literally, I have a list of a couple dozen ideas that have nothing to do with Detroit.
Well, I'd love to get into those at some point a little bit later, too. I think that'd be kind of fun to dive into.
A lot of them are sports-related, baseball-related. This one, this latest one, takes me in a little different direction in that I've, most of my narrative nonfiction has been baseball-related, and this certainly has a strong baseball story in it, but it also has the crime story, so this was a little bit of a stretch for me, an intentional stretch, wanting to do something that's a little bit outside of my, out of my comfort zone, and so that was a challenge.
In what way was it out of your comfort zone?
Yeah, well, in terms of book-length work, I mean, my background is journalistic, and I've written everything journalism-wise in terms of subjects. I'm not, not originally a sports reporter. And so I've covered politics and government and police and law enforcement, but I've never done it in a book form. And so even though I've used, as a journalist over the years, the Freedom of Information Act repeatedly and, obtained documents and studied them, never done it in book form. And in this case, during the City of Champions, there's, a story that focuses on a secret society called the Black Legion. And so I was going through, 900-plus pages of FBI files and, hundreds of state police reports and court documents and transcripts. And I've done that kind of stuff before, certainly, in day-to-day journalism, but never in book form. And so trying to give shape to that was just a little bit of a different challenge. I think what I determined in the end is really subject matter doesn't really matter. When you're writing a book, whether it's on sports or whether it's on a crew that's killing people, you're looking for the same things. You're looking for strong characters. You're looking for telling detail. You're looking for little bits of information that are going to reveal motivation or reveal warts, make somebody human. And you're looking for events that are kind of crucial in the narrative.
And I wonder what, in reading, like, sort of the key figure for the Black Legion essentially becomes, in a lot of ways, this reluctant pawn, Dayton Dean. He was always sort of constricted by the Legion to go out and commit these acts of murder, and then he, for one reason or another, he sort of can't pull the trigger, can't place the bomb throughout most of it. And without giving too much away in terms of his path throughout the book, you kind of get a sense through him the terror of the Legion, not only impressed upon the city and some of the region at large, but also within its own membership, just the terror that they're able to instill on the people that they sort of strong arm into their own fraternity, is really well illustrated through his arc in the book. And I was wondering, like, how did you come to him specifically as the one to kind of carry us through the Legion?
I'm glad there was a lot of information on him because he is an interesting character, but it's also the fact that there was a lot of information on him that allowed me to do it, because he ends up being the guy who talks. Mm-hmm. You're a member of the Black Legion. You're told repeatedly, the only former Legion members are dead. Anytime you speak of our secret society, your life is in danger. You do it under threat of death. And when the thing starts falling apart, he's the one who speaks up. And it's because of his testimony that people get sent away, including him. And so, because he did talk, he did interviews with the media back in the day, there was more material available on him than on anybody else. And fortunately, in his case, he's kind of an interesting character, and he's central to a lot of the crimes that get prosecuted. A whole lot of crimes did not get prosecuted, dozens of murders, and it's because people kept the secret. Didn't talk, and I think it's also because there was a cover-up that there were a lot of political figures using the Legion to get votes, and if there had been a full investigation, a lot of big names would have gone down. But Dayton Dean, at some point, I think realized, even though he wasn't a very bright guy, and originally was into it not so much out of fear, but because he embraced the mission, and like the excitement, realized that he was a pawn, that he was being used, that people weren't leveling with him when they assigned him various tasks. And so he's just, he fits into the story nicely.
So how did you end up in 1934 and 1935 era Detroit? Like, how did you come to the story and end up in that time period?
It really does trace to my childhood, when my aunts and uncles would be sharing stories of their childhood. And I was an obsessive sports fan in the 11, 12 years old. And we had very few successes to root for in Detroit at that time, sports-wise. The Tigers had won the World Series in 68, but I was 7 years old, didn't really remember much of that. And, you know, in 72, our Tiger team went into the playoffs against the Oakland A's, and so that was kind of the highlight in terms of team success in Detroit during my childhood. But my uncles would tell of this time when they were 14, 15 years old, in my dad's case, and the Tigers won, you know, went to the World Series in 34, then won it in 35. A month later, the Lions win the NF title, and the Lions never won anything in my lifetime. And the Red Wings, you know, in the following spring, take the Stanley Cup. And at the same time, Joe Louis is the uncrowned, undefeated champion of boxing, uncrowned because he obviously was African-American and had not been given a shot yet at the title. And so it just seems such a glorious time. I grew up with that era because, you know, in my case, probably in your case, in most sports fans' cases, when you're coming of age, the sports heroes you have are always going to hold a special place in your heart. And it was the same with my dad. He used to, you know, when he's in his 90s, he might not remember what he had for breakfast that morning, but he could still recite the lineup of the 1935 Detroit Tigers, the team. Wow. He first cherished and grew up with, and the one that included his hero, Charlie Gehringer. And so I grew up with those names because my dad liked to reminisce, and I enjoyed hearing him reminisce. And I knew I would eventually write something about that time period. The challenge as a writer is, you know, when you're, one of the challenges is writing about a period where none of the key figures is alive anymore. And so you're kind of, you don't have interviews you can do. You can do them with family members who are a generation or two removed, but often their stories aren't always reliable. They're good for, you know, adding bits of character and pieces of personality. But in terms of factual confirmation of things, they don't always have that down, and they often have family lore. But I knew I would be writing about that period at some point, and I have written about it, and you know, it comes into play in other books I've done. The Final Season, which was my memoir of the last year at Tiger State, and really a father-son story of my relationship with my dad. And they figure into that, and they figure into the follow-up book, The Road to Cooperstown, which was also another memoir. I knew there was a lot of material there. You have, you know, from a baseball standpoint, not just the four guys who would go on to the Hall of Fame, Greenberg, Gehringer, Cochran, and Goose Goslin, but just some really rich characters like Schoolboy Rowe, who just kind of set the nation on fire as he had a 15-16 game winning streak in 1934, and he and his girlfriend, Edna, future wife, become national celebrities for a while after he mentions her on the air on the Rudy Vallee show. So there was just so much material there. And, of course, it's taking place 34-35. Detroit was incredibly hard hit by the Depression, 40% unemployment rate. We had some of the first bank closures, we had a bank holiday, kept the banks from closing in 33. You know, it's Prohibition's coming to an end. It's just it's a really ripe time in terms of material.
Yeah, and when you do this type of historical narrative nonfiction, I'm always intrigued about a lot of the themes and how they really translate into the future, and how it's just sometimes it just feels like, as an old history teacher once said to us in the class, he's like, times changes, technology changes, but people don't. And it was interesting how, sure, this was in 1930s Detroit, but so much of the fear and themes and just, you know, the hope that so many of us will put in sports is just as a way to distract are so prescient to today's world. And I was wondering, like, how much thought you How present was that in your mind as you were writing this book, that it, even though it took place over, you know, 80 years ago or so, that it was almost like 2015 United States Detroit era, just with different costumes?
Yeah, it became more prevalent as I was working on the book, because, you know, I was thinking, as I'm doing it, secret society, you know, hate-motivated group, kind of like a Klan on steroids, you know, more violent than the Ku Klux Klan. And then as I'm writing, as I'm researching, I'm thinking, well, you know, we really don't have that same kind of thing in the numbers we're talking. I mean, this had tens of thousands of members in Southeast Michigan. It was also flourishing in Ohio and Indiana. And so as I'm initially starting out, I'm thinking, we still have hate groups, but, you know, they're fortunately, not nearly as dominant as they were in an earlier era. But as I dug deeper into it, it was startling to me how so many of the issues that we debate today were still at the forefront back then. I mean, one of the leaders of the Black Legion, when he's finally interviewed by an FBI agent, it's obvious that, one of his big issues is the Second Amendment and what that means for, individuals owning guns, because it was more restrictive back in that era. You needed to, did apply for permits in Detroit. I'm not sure how it went other places, and you had to have people co-sign for you, preferably people of authority. And so that's how, one of the ways Mickey Cochran got his gun, the Tiger's manager back in, his handgun anyways. Shotguns, rifles, not such a big deal. But you have him spouting this leader of the Black Legion, reading the Second Amendment to the FBI agent, who I'm sure was already familiar with it. You have Black Legionnaires claiming that FDR is disregarding the Constitution, that he's violating the Constitution. So you see echoes of that in terms of how people have viewed Obama, some people. You have the whole debate over immigration. I mean, at its heart, the Black Legion is a white male Protestant organization, and it's American-born folks are allowed in. And so they're against folks who have immigrated from, in this case, it tends to be Europe. They tend to be against Catholics and Jews. And so, it's a different group that immigration is about now, but it's still immigration. You have these Black Legionnaires referring to FDR as a socialist, and people worrying about the direction of the country. I mean, it was coming a little bit out of the Great Depression at that stage, 34, 35, 33, I think, was the worst year. But, so people have a lot of anxiety. They see their way of life changing, or at least temporarily. They've lost their factory jobs, many of them. As it turned out, a lot of the Black Legionnaires did not lose their jobs, probably because they were co-opted into the anti-union fight in the Detroit area, so they tended to have jobs in the factories. They kept their jobs or got them back quickly. So, you do see echoes of other times, or at least I did, in ways that I didn't expect.
Now, in your extensive research for the book, what was the feeling as you were digging this stuff up? Because I imagine you just realize maybe the more you read, just the more stuff keeps digging up and it keeps coming to the surface. And you just, as someone researching and wanting to write the story about it, I imagine that there was a point or several points where you're like, man, I can't believe what I'm finding. And I wonder what that was like as you, the research process and how you were processing all the stuff you were reading.
Yeah, you start with the basic reporting of that was happening in the papers at the time. There were three Detroit dailies, and eventually the Black Legion story does go broader than that. But I relied first on the Detroit dailies, and then you try to find what court transcripts you can, and obviously the FBI files and state police files, and then there are also archives. There was a historian in the '70s who did quite a bit of research on the Black Legion, never published anything. series with figures while they were still alive, which was great. Yeah, I mean, it can get overwhelming because you have thousands of news stories, and you have to figure out who's exaggerating, who's not, and you know, you can do that by comparing the stories from the same period and seeing what's getting repeated, what's not, and then you get a sense of which papers. I mean, there was a Hearst paper here at the time, the Detroit Times, and they sometimes tended to play a little looser with information. And so you're sorting a day, and it gets overwhelming, certainly, and you have to winnow it down. You have to focus it. You know, not the first writer to say that a lot of writing is about omission, you know, what you don't put in the story, because it's so easy to get cluttered. And even as it is, I suspect I have too much information in the book. Possibly. I mean, it's difficult. It's difficult to know, but it's the version I have at this point, and I am pleased with it. But it
for just as someone who reads a lot of books, it doesn't feel cluttered in the least bit. It reads really well. It's very well paced, and the way you're able to braid together these two paths that don't necessarily intersect, like the sports in the Black Legion, but the way you braid it together just makes a really compelling 3D portrait of that era of Detroit. So, job well done. I don't think you have to worry about it being cluttered, for sure, at least from my point of view.
Well, thank you. So, I mean, it's, you know, you're sorting through a lot of information, and, you know, when you really dig deep into a story and you're researching it, the little things that, you know, the little aha moments may not... they're few and far between when you really get into it. But I guess one of the big ones for me was just seeing page after page in the FBI documents, little notes that J. Edgar Hoover would put on reports, on letters, telling his staff how to respond to something or responding himself, indicating that, you know, we're not going to investigate this. This is we don't have authorization. And he didn't want to look for authorization. He was avoiding investigating the Black Legion. You know, that really struck me, because if he had really gone full force at it, a whole lot of people would have not died, in my view. And so it was kind of a frustrating little realization as you're going, you know, and it, you know, it, of course, hindsight is 20/20, but I don't know. I just, that kind of infuriated me as I dug deeper into the documents of realizing that lives could have been saved. You know, somebody's father wouldn't have died had somebody taken this investigation more seriously.
So, how did you organize this material before you got to the nitty-gritty of trying to stitch together a narrative through all the stuff that you were able to dig up?
Yeah. With a, you know, nonfiction narrative, to some degree, you're going to be following a chronology. And so I always, early on in the process, I always come up with timelines and keep adding to a timeline, until I can pick out the key moments, the key scenes, the key crimes, the overlapping areas, looking for connections. I was hoping so much to find really strong connections between the sports and the Legion, and there were some. You know, certainly in Detroit area, the Legion, there's tended to be baseball fans. There were a lot of baseball fans who planned the timing of some of their crimes around the Detroit Tigers schedule. You know, if we're going to take this guy out and beat him, might as well wait till after the game's done, you know, to do it. And of course, one of their famous murders, they use baseball, which was, you know, was on everybody's mind. Even though we're a city of champions, and you have the, you know, the various teams that win championships and a lot of individuals who win championships, by far it was the Tigers and Joe Louis who were driving the conversation in Detroit. Everybody was talking about baseball. So, you know, I was looking for those overlaps, but I do start with timelines, and You know, I just have a very involved filing system where, you know, literally boxes of file folders, individual characters, and specific crimes, and you just keep adding to those until you're able to flesh out an entire scene. Not sure if that really illustrates it, gets at what you were asking.
But. Oh, yeah. No, definitely, because I'm always interested in the process writers take. You know, some people, you know, Bronwyn Dickey, who wrote, you know, Pitbull, Battle Over an American Icon, who I spoke with a couple weeks ago. Like, she, like you, just read so much stuff. She wasn't able to, like, properly organize. She chose to use Evernote, a way to digitize it and then tag it and search it. So that helped her organize all her notes, and she was able to, you know, tackle her chapters at that point. And then I'm more of an analog person myself, so it's like hearing you say, like, you know, you've got these file boxes with, you know, papers and stuff. I think it's kind of interesting to see how certain minds process all this material, and then you see the finished product, and it's just like, oh, wow, it's kind of neat to sort of reverse engineer it and see how it came to be.
Yeah, I am a little bit old school on that. I mean, if I were going to digitize everything, I would have to be scanning lots of microfilm and microfiche copies, because as you're going through it, you don't necessarily know what key little notation might be in a story that you're going to want to refer to later. So I tend to have file folders that are full of microfilmed copies, and those are often of poor quality. And I'm not sure that you could even scan them and have them without a whole lot of heartache later on trying to decipher and reorganize. So, yeah, I am old school in terms of file folders and copies, and that way the material's there when you go back that you can, you're not having to reinterpret every story as you go. And you can kind of look for tidbits. You don't know, I mean, until you really get into the guts of the developing the story, you don't know really what key little detail you might suddenly discover that you need or that you're trying to confirm. For example, I mean, it's just a little minor thing, but I'm dealing with nonfiction here, and so I take that my mission seriously. It's nonfiction. I'm not making up things here, and I try to require that I have the same verification process that I have when I'm working on day-to-day journalism. And so you want to be right. That's first and foremost. So little things like, at one point the FBI had sent out agents in different cities to some addresses in various cities. And so it was dead ended in Detroit. They sent somebody out, go to this address because there was a return envelope, that we noticed at this guy's post office box, and go see who lives there. And so in the report, it's saying this person lives here, and they appear to have nothing to do with the Black Legion. So looking at that address, and so this is nowhere in the FBI file, but the address sounds familiar to me. So I start going through back through my files because I had also created like an address file, cross-referencing things, and I discovered, you know, the FBI didn't, I discovered there was one of the key Black Legionnaires who lived at this address. Now that, I mean, that seems like such a minor little thing in the scheme of a 100,000-word book, and it is, but it sure made me feel good to be able to add a sentence in there that, you know, the FBI was either fooled or the local agent, ignored the evidence, but either way, they missed it. And it's not a key moment in the book, but, you know, just being able to uncover tiny little things like that factually, it makes you feel good.
And I wonder, too, with a book like this, and like so much of the seed of it came from memories that, you know, your fathers and grandfathers had sort of bestowed upon you and like told you about this era. And I wonder, before your father passed away, how much you talked to him about the book you were working on that became Terror in the City of Champions, and what what those conversations were like, and how, even though your dad isn't in the book, like, how much did your father factor into it?
Well, certainly in the sports aspect, he was very helpful in terms of capturing the excitement of the era. And the he growing up, I would hear the stories, and I'd have him repeat them for me later on. You know, you pick his mind and hope to get little treasures out. But you know, I always remember the stories of the celebrations that would happen after the Tigers won the World Series, or the kids taking pots into the cooking pots into the street and banging them with wooden spoons, you know, as to make noise, or getting to listen to the 35 World Series games in schools. You know, somebody would bring in a radio and went to a parochial school, and the sisters would allow the whole school to listen to the Tigers, and so that's where he heard that World Series be won as the heroes with Mickey Cochran and Goslin scoring in the final inning, and it brought it to life. It personalized it. He would talk about the days when Joe Louis was fighting, how you could walk down the sidewalks of most neighborhoods in Detroit, and you could hear the sounds of the radio sounds of that fight wafting into the street from the open windows on a summer night. As you just walk down the street, it would be coming from numerous homes, and you could just kind of hear the fight as you, even if you weren't in front of a radio yourself. And so, we talked about it. He didn't know so much about the Black Legion. A whole lot of people seem to have forgotten about the Black Legion. But when it was exposed, it created a national hysteria because it was a secret society, and suddenly, wives and mothers and daughters are learning that the men in their lives were members, and they had no idea. Or you learn that your neighbor's a member, and you're wondering, well, who else? Or you hear that the police force is honeycombed with members. So who do you trust? And so it created a hysteria, and it spawned a couple movies, including one with Humphrey Bogart, relatively early in his career. And I believe there was a novel that it spawned, and a play, and works of art. And it had international coverage. And back in the day, we obviously didn't have television, so you didn't have the true police stories that we now have on TV, but you did have the detective magazines, probably 12, 13, 14 different ones, true detective kind of things, true crimes. And the Black Legion was a cover story on many of them. Everybody affiliated with it in the law enforcement end was being paid money to have a story ghostwritten from their viewpoint. My dad didn't personally know much about the Black Legion. There was one of my uncles who used to, the oldest of the uncles, who would tell a story about thinking he had been picked up by the Black Legion, but discovering, in fact, that it was undercover police officers.
So you've written a bunch of books, and I wonder which, if there was a single one, great, but what book was maybe the most challenging for you to write?
They all have different kinds of challenges. The final season, the Tiger Stadium memoir, is always going to have a special place in my heart. I did write a book that I don't always include prior to that. I co-authored a reference book called Elton John from A to Z with another obsessive Elton fan. But I really start my count with the final season. It took me in a different direction. And so one of the challenges, my first two books were memoir, and then the three since then have been journalistic in nature and set in decades past. Memoir, one of the challenges is, fact-checking memories. When you discover some family story that you've heard, that doesn't really match up time frame-wise to what was happening somewhere else. And so, family stories get glossed over. You also get that when you're doing journalism, too. You know, somebody will be insistent that something happened. And when I was working on the Hank Aaron book, for example, with that one, lots of people are still alive who played with Hank Aaron. So you do a lot of interviews of folks who are looking back on things that had happened 30 years ago at that, when I was working on the book. And they tended, just for one example, to, you know, every time they were remembering a Hank Aaron home run, they were remembering it in the most heroic terms, you know, ninth inning, bases loaded, game on the line. And you start fact-checking that thing, and you come to find out, oh, no, that game actually was 7-1, the home run occurred in the fifth inning. And, so, you know, that is kind of a different kind of challenge. With the Ty Cobb, Babe Ruth book, I kind of had the opposite challenge. You didn't have anybody alive when I was working on the book who had played with Ty Cobb during his major league days, and only a couple who were still alive at that point who had played with Babe Ruth. And you've undoubtedly interviewed folks, famous folks, and they tend to, you know, when you're decades removed from an event, they tend to have the glossy stories that they tell. You know, they've burnished them over the years, and penetrating those, getting beyond them, it can be difficult. And so you'll encounter, when you're doing your research in the Tie in the Bait book, stories that that have been repeated so many times that they're no longer questioned. There's a lot of that stuff with Cobb and Ruth, in Cobb's case, just kind of being portrayed as the Satan of baseball, which really wasn't how he was viewed in his era.
Hmm.
Charles Learson recently wrote, very compellingly about that, trying to change how Cobb is viewed, and challenging a lot of those stereotypes. I challenged some of those in the book I had done. But so, I guess I really went off a tangent there, but, it's different challenges. It's not that one particular book project stands out. It's just they all have different aspects of it. But I think doing the first one is always, you learn as you go. So the first one is really a learning experience. I think probably the final season was most challenging.
Well, that one probably, in a lot of ways, just cut to the bone in a way that others don't, especially, it being a father-son story, but also seeing, your iconic Tiger Stadium demolished. I'm sure, what was that like for you to be there for that entire, I believe it was the 99 season?
Right.
Was that it? That final season, and then I having to see the place demolished. I mean, what was that like for you?
Yeah, well, the 99 season was the finality of it, and it was, when I started the book, I thought I was really doing a history of the place, and, I thought baseball, what was taking place on the field, might drive the story, but it ended up being something much more personal as we were getting into it. The real powerful story was, my relationship with my father, how four generations of our family had shared the game there, how this was one of the last places we could connect since the old family home had disappeared from the landscape, like a lot of them in Detroit and other big cities. And so it became a very personal story. And so it was actually, as I'm going through the season, it's a process of revelation as I'm coming to realize it's not just about the ballpark and the heroes that I had seen there, but, it's about my father aging and, the fact that he wasn't always going to be with me. And, I come to that realization at some point. The ballpark actually wasn't knocked down for quite a while. It just stood vacant for a while. So we had probably a 10-year reprieve where, the ballpark was vacant and empty and still standing at the corner.
Hmm.
And eventually demolished. And even after it was demolished, up until just a couple weeks ago, for 4 or 5 years, there was a group of folks, volunteers, called the Navenfield Grounds Crew. It's Tiger Stadium. First open was called Navenfield. These guys would keep that diamond, just keep the infield diamond going, and people would come out every Sunday to play baseball on the place. Now, it, just in the last week or two, the field itself has been erased. It's going to be replaced and with you know, a fake grass, and it'll have a ball field for kids through the Police Athletic League. A lot of programming on it. Very controversial here. So, I mean, it resonates even all these years later. And it's, you know, we're coming within a couple of years. It's going to be 20 years after the fact since Tiger Stadium was last used for a major league game, and it's still in the news here. It resonates in that way.
So, when you were growing up, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, I wanted to be a baseball player.
Me too.
Yeah. I think a lot of us can relate to that. And then at some point you realize you're, I don't know how, it may have taken you longer to realize maybe you're more talented than I. At some point, you if you're not going to make it, you come to that realization. And it seemed to me the next best thing would be to be a sports reporter. And as I actually got into journalism, it wasn't sports originally, and I found I liked other aspects of journalism, you know, political reporting and government reporting. And so it kind of took me away, and I, at 22 years old, with some other friends, I started a weekly newspaper, not thinking what would happen if it succeeded, and it succeeded, grew into a small group of newspapers in Northeast Michigan, in Southeast Michigan, northeast of Detroit.
So I'm sorry, when you were 22, you and some friends started your own paper?
Yeah, we started a little weekly newspaper, and you know, through hard work and diligence and good reporting, it succeeded, and it grew into a small group. We kept expanding. It grew into a small group of 5 weekly newspapers, northeast of Detroit, in the suburbs. And after 16 years, we sold them. The papers, and that coincided, the sale coincided with the last year at Tiger Stadium.
Huh.
And so it allowed me to...
was that in the book, in the final season, or...?
Yeah.
It was, shoot, I can't remember, I'm sorry, I forgot
that. No, it's probably only a sentence or two in passing of the book, but it took place, yeah, that the middle of the Tiger season, when the deal was finally consummated. And,
so your newspaper conglomerate gets sold, and the final season, the Tigers are playing at your famed Tiger Stadium. Wow, I mean, we talk about a watershed year for you.
It was a big one, yes. And meanwhile, my wife is thinking I'm having a midlife crisis, I think, you know, going to all 81 home games, and never done that before, but it's kind of... realizing I had to do it that year if I were ever going to go to every game at Tiger Stadium, as I vowed I would do when I was a kid and much smarter than my dad, you know, who wouldn't allow, you know, wouldn't buy the full season passes because we couldn't afford it. But nonetheless, you know, it was a childhood dream. And so, yeah, we ended up selling the papers, which gave me, you know, some freedom to pursue book writing full time. And I did that for quite a while, and then I wasn't intending to become a journalism professor, but I just had reached that stage, and coincidentally was where I wanted to give back, and coincidentally had visited a campus where I had friends teaching, and they had a teaching position open, full-time journalism position, and was at the alma mater of one of my mentors who had just died, Neil Schein, who was... top editor at the Free Press in Detroit and a very well-known figure in journalism in our region. And I just decided it would be nice to try to repay him by encouraging a generation of younger journalists at his alma mater. And so my productivity book-wise has slowed down. I think everybody gets into, not everybody, many people, writers, when they get into teaching, think they're going to have a whole lot of time to write. And then,
Yeah, kind of like talking a little more about your starting that newspaper and how it grew. I mean, just what was temporally speaking, like what was the year that you started the first paper?
Yeah, well, if I'm being totally honest, we started one that in December of 1982, we tried to start an arts and entertainment paper in blue-collar Macomb County during the recession, and that lasted about 3 issues, and we were running out of money because we had all borrowed money from family, and we decided, well, we better go back to doing what we know, which was, we'd all worked for local community newspapers at that point. So we switched over to a local community paper, and it was a free circulation delivered by mail to everybody's home, but it wasn't a shopper in that our news coverage was better than the paid papers in the area. It was serious news coverage. And over time, it just it really took off, and you give your all to it, and you're in your early 20s, you can work those 80, 90-hour weeks and do it for a couple of years, and the success followed. It was some of it was luck, some of it was being smart about what we did, some of it was the fact that the market where we started the paper started to boom, a lot of growth. It was a high growth in the 1980s, so we... just a lot of things came together, and it blossomed. And then when we sold, it was because there was somebody was trying to had a larger strategy, media strategy. They were trying to encircle Detroit with suburban papers, and so if we had waited till now, I'm sure I wouldn't be able to unload the papers. It is difficult to sell newspapers now, but so we got out at the right time, and it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it while we were doing it. But one of the things that I was never able to totally manage was the realization as the paper succeeded, just the very nature of them required that I become more of a manager of people, and it took me further away from what I really enjoyed, which was writing. So as the enterprise grows and you hire more reporters and staff in other areas, it's you're no longer the reporter who's going out on assignment and enjoying that challenge. You're now in charge of a lot of other people and the day-to-day of managing other people. That really wasn't what I wanted to do. And so I'm sure there are entrepreneurs who can manage that more successfully than I did. But in my case, the success of the publication, which I appreciated financially because it allowed me to take care of my family, took me away from what I actually enjoyed. So being able to sell and being able to write books for, pretty much full time for almost, I guess 8-9 years, was a great reward.
So what compelled you at age 22 to even start this venture? Because that's usually the time that most people are going to cut their teeth at smaller papers or bigger papers and be working for someone and doing it. But I wonder what was your headspace like to eschew that altogether and start your own paper?
Yeah, it probably was that I hadn't given it a lot of thought, to be honest. I was at that point feeling kind of invincible, and so I never really gave much thought to, what if this fails? I end up owing, my future mother-in-law, whatever it was I borrowed, that she so graciously put toward the project. I never really gave some thought, well, how am I ever going to repay her back if this doesn't work? But I had already, I was one of those kids who couldn't afford to go away to college and didn't have the kind of grades that would give me a scholarship anywhere. And so I ended up working my way through college, and so my first newspaper job was with a weekly when I was 18 years old, and I was working, for those 3 or 4 years before I started my own paper at another weekly in the same area, and so it really was you know, it was kind of a, I already knew what I was doing that way, but in terms of having a whole lot of thought process into it, it was probably a whole lot less thought process than I probably should have put into it, and was very fortunate that it worked out in some ways. I mean, that's if I'm being totally honest about it. I don't think I had some glaring genius that that motivated the decision.
That's probably why it succeeded so well, because you didn't overthink it, and you just kind of plunged in. And I think a lot of the best entrepreneurs, there's some planning involved, but a lot of it is they just get over the lizard brain fear that will rationalize yourself from doing something like that. And you just kind of dove in to the deep end and saw what happened. If it failed, it failed, but it clearly succeeded. So it's like, I think there's a big lesson to be learned in just how you approach that. It's just sometimes you just got to dive in with your whole body and just do it.
Yeah, I mean, that's a very good point, because I look now, you know, in my mid-50s, and I, you know, occasionally think, oh, well, why don't I start this or start that? But you have more to lose when you're you're later in life, you know, or when your kids are growing up. Mine are adults now, but you know, you have more that you're putting at risk, and you know. And I know there are lots of entrepreneurs who do that all throughout their lives, but in my case, I think it was partly the product of just being young and feeling rather invincible and probably overly competent.
So I wonder, what might be the greatest piece of advice that your father ever gave you?
Oh, wow. My dad was not money motivated. Most of his career worked for the government, usually doing like darkroom tech work, sometimes photography, and it's just money was never he had a good retirement from the government, but money was never a driving force for him. And he always emphasized probably the same advice that a lot of other parents give, do something with your life that you're going to enjoy, because you're going to be doing it for a long time. Don't do something just in pursuit of the dollar, because you won't be happy with that. And for the most part, actually, he wasn't an advice giver. You know, he would give advice if you asked, but it was more modeling his behavior. He was always gave people the benefit of a doubt, and that's something I've tried to do. He would tell me that when he encountered somebody who would mistreat him, you know, somebody like he never met, or somebody who was snappy or something in some kind of a business setting, he would just figure that that perhaps they were just coming off something horrible in their life, that maybe that morning that they had had a fight with somebody they loved, or that they had maybe their parent was in the hospital, or spouse, or, and so it was always to give somebody the benefit of a doubt, you know, assume the best about people, and it's not always easy to live by, but it is something that I learned from them that I try to model.
And when you were, you know, going down this path of journalism, being a writer, what were maybe 3 to 5 just influential books that had a big impact on you and made you want to continue down that path, and books that you revisited and reread to see, like, wow, that's how it's done. That's how I sharpen the saw, by reading this.
I have a soft spot in my heart for memoir, and one of the writers I came upon early in my career was Willie Morris, who may not be all that well known. The first book I came upon of his is not all that well known. It was a book of essays called Terrains of the Heart and Other Essays on Home. And Willie Morris was a Southern Boy Rhodes scholar, University of Mississippi, and he wrote, this isn't the work I'd want to remember him for, but if people aren't familiar with his work, they may know him for a little piece he wrote that became a movie called My Dog Skip, with the kid from Malcolm in the Middle. But I mean, that's not the work I would point to as. but he wrote a memoir called Good Old Boy, about growing up in the South, which really touched me. I mean, it's difficult when you look at, for me, you look back, trying to figure out why certain works touch you at a given moment in your life. And maybe they wouldn't later, but that one, I go back to Willie Morris's books. I tend not to reread entire books, but I will go back for inspiration and read a chapter here or there. Baseball-wise, I have very fond memories of reading Kinsella's Shoeless Joe, which became the basis for Field of Dreams. Mm-hmm. It was a book when my wife and I were dating, that we first time I'd ever done this, read a book together. We read to your early romantic years, you're reading a book to one another, taking turns, and it was just such a, I know for some people Kinsella's stuff is a little too romantic and maybe even sentimental, but it, at the stage in life when I was reading it, I totally loved it, and so that's another one I go back to. Over time, I go back to some of the classics from the 20s and 30s because I had an uncle who tried to make me into a novelist by giving me, he was a failed writer, I guess, and for decades, every Christmas, he would give me his used books that he wanted me to read. We're not talking one or two, I'm talking like hundreds over the years. This is probably going to be a book or a memoir I write at some point, mm-hmm. like a reading list he had for me. And finally, in middle age, I started going back and reading them. But and that tended to be the Hemingway and F. Scott Fitzgerald and Caldwell. But his favorite writer was Thomas Wolfe, the first one, Look Homeward, Angel. And I think there's a movie out right now about his relationship with his agent Maxwell Perkins. Called Genius. I don't know if the movie's any good. I haven't seen it. But Thomas Wolfe has very lush writing, and I'll occasionally read from Look Homeward, Angel. And more recent years, so Kinsella for baseball, but I enjoy oral histories too, so Lawrence Ritter's Glory of Their Times is one that I draw on. For inspiration, Jerome Holtzman did No Cheering in the Press Box, interviews with sports writers from another era I enjoy. Pat Conroy, Mary Carr's Liar's Club, Tobias Wolfe, Old School, and one about his boyhood memoir. I'm probably giving way too many, but...
No, that's great. It's
just sense.
It's great to hear the reading list that inspires other writers. I think it's kind of the books you have on your bookshelf, and especially maybe the 5 to 10 books that if the house were burning down and you had a backpack to throw a few books in, like what would those books be? I think those tell a lot about who the person is and what they value in their taste and sensibility. So I love hearing these books that inspire you to do what you do.
It is interesting because I think it's so much of it I think is when you read it too, and what else is happening in your life, and it's difficult to quantify that. But it's kind of that stage when you're first discovering certain writers and discovering writers for yourself. It's one thing if people are recommending them, but when you come upon a writer that your friends aren't talking about, and that your teachers aren't talking about, and it may not be that the person is historically going to be the most have a place in the pantheon, but you discover the person at a certain point in your life, and it means something to you, and And, you know, Willie Morris is a very well-respected writer, but I feel like he's probably mine more than he's anybody else's I know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that makes sense even. But
yeah, I feel like I came to Kurt Vonnegut like that. Like, I had heard the name, but I was at a Walden Bookstores maybe in 1999 or 2000, and I was just going up to the bookshelves looking for a book to read, and I just... the name popped out, and I just ran. I kind of closed my eyes, put my hand out, picked out a book, and it was Slaughterhouse-Five. And so, like, that was my indoctrination to Vonnegut, and I've since read all his, you know, all his books. I have a kinship with his style, who I often consider him kind of like the first blogger, because a lot of his pages are like, a lot of his sections are these almost 200-word snippets all broken up. So yeah, I see what you mean. It's like you come to somebody on your own, and so you kind of have ownership over that,
right.
And then you have that connection.
You mentioned Vonnegut. This is totally off target here, but the way I found my agent was, and I've been with the same agent, Philip Spitzer, for since day one, but. I came to my agent as a result of an essay I read by Andre Dubuque on called the Andre Dubuque's son is an author as well, who wrote House of Sand and Fog and wrote a memoir called Townie, and he talks in Townie about spending time with Vonnegut, how his father, the older Andre Dubuque.
Yeah, the short story writer.
Yeah, they were both right, and they were friends, and they would. Spend time at one another's homes, but it just reminded me because I found my agent based on reading one of Andre Dubuque's, the father's essays, once he was in a wheelchair meditations from a movable chair, about going to Fenway Park with his agent, and it was really the impetus for me to write the guy. But yeah, Vonnegut is such a key figure.
Yeah, absolutely. And, there's definitely a lot of stuff we can still go on. But, like, yeah, we're up. We've been talking for an hour. Your vocal cords have hung in beautifully. And, I want to maybe be respectful of your time and let you go. But I wonder, lastly, with your latest book, I'll say the name again, Terror in the City of Champions. Just, like, what else, what has been... the experience of promoting it so far, and where do you see it going, and what other work do you have to do with it for the remainder of the summer?
Yeah, well, I have a lot of appearances, and then you start with the bookstore appearances, trying to drive people into to purchase it. Where the various daily papers have been excerpting parts of it, and I've been getting good turnouts at the appearances, and you end up doing festivals in the fall, and so there's lots of appearances on my schedule. It's entertaining to have people come out. I've had a couple people come out. No family members yet of Black Legion members, but I've made contact with family members of some victims, and it's interesting. I have, one of the concerns you have, even though this organization is, was supposedly put out of commission in the 30s, they do have family members who may not appreciate having their, ancestors' names dredged up in this kind of story. So you're always in the back of your mind wondering if you're going to have some kind of harsh encounter with somebody. But, I don't know where it's going. It's been requested by a couple of people who are looking at it possibly for movie option, but I don't know, how that goes.
Yeah, well, that's got to be exciting, though. All the elements are there. It's for the action. There's a lot of tension and drama in it. There's, like we said very much earlier, like it's kind of, it takes place 80 years ago, but it feels very modern in a lot of ways.
Always hope you get that kind of a payday.
Of course, I can keep doing more books.
Yeah, that's right. So, But
and has it been encouraging to see the turnout? I mean, the picture I saw on Facebook for you, for Barnes & Noble appearance you did, it may have been your first reading or your first signing. I mean, you had a human size height stack of books. I mean, that's got to be great to,
yeah,
to see that.
Yeah, it is. It is nice. I've not had a book out in, I've not been out promoting a new book probably in 9 years. And so, you know, you always wonder if, you know, the people who read you last time, whether they're still going to care about what you're doing this many years later. You know, so much has changed in the way we promote books in that time. You know, when I did Tie and the Babe, you know, there was no Facebook.
Yeah.
You know, so the kind of social media that you were doing was basically email lists at that point.
And, yeah, now podcasts have taken off, this is a way to do like a digital book tour. You can do a lot of this stuff, and then it just stays there. It's kind of, I try to keep the interviews I do as evergreen as possible, so anyone can listen to it maybe in a year or two, and it's still... there's nothing that necessarily dates it, so people can learn about your book for, you know, years to come if they ever stumble upon it, upon the podcast, I mean. So it's...
So I do appreciate it, Brendan. Thank you for taking the time to talk with me. I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, fantastic. And one last thing.
Sure.
Where can people find you online and, you know, find the book and, you know, see you online, engage with you, and then, you know, find and buy the book?
Sure, yeah. It's for a while we were having availability issues because the publisher underestimated demand, and we were out for a while. But it looks like we've been replenished everywhere. So you should be able to order us from any of the usual outlets. But you can find me personally... my name, TomStanton.com, and my website. There are links there to my Facebook presence, which I'm very active on, and use Twitter less frequently, but there's a link there to that as well. And I love corresponding with people, and for people to reach out, I always respond. So I look forward to that point, interacting with others.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thanks again for carving out some time in your morning here, Tom, and best of success with the book. I loved it, and I encourage everyone to go out and buy it and buy a copy for their friends and so forth. So,
I appreciate that, Brendan, and look forward to talking with you again.
All right. Sounds great, Tom. Take care.
All